This is Donald Hasig with Cancer Action News Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Joining us today is a very special guest. She is the director of the High Peaks Office of Catskill Mountain Keeper. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning, Donald.
Give us your background. You know, give us. This is Kathleen Nolan, MD. Kathleen Nolan, MD. Give us some of your background and your position. And this is an interview about the role of Catskill Mountain Keeper in stopping shale gas exploitation in New York State. I'm certain this is going to happen. There's so much power and energy in the groups that are coalescing around this issue, and the Catskill Mountain Keeper is one of the very, very powerful frontline groups on this, with such a strong stance of we oppose this practice in our state. Tell us about who you are.
I'm a physician, trained as a pediatrician. In recent years, I've been working primarily at a public health kind of approach to environmental issues, working with nonprofit organizations in the area where I live here in the Catskill Park. And I joined the staff of Catskill Mountain Keeper a year ago as Mountain Keeper was opening an office in Woodstock. And I was partly motivated to do that because of Mountain Keeper's strong work on the fracking issue. When I first started looking at the issue, I thought, well, perhaps there's a place to do fracking safely. The staff at Mountain Keeper didn't agree with that. They said that they hadn't been able to find one, and they kind of challenged me to find a place where I thought it would be safe to do this new drilling technique to bring up methane gas, often called natural gas, but to bring up methane from deep deposits in the earth. And over the first several months that I worked with Mountain Keeper, I did try to figure out a way that I thought this activity could be conducted safely, and I haven't been able to find that way yet either. So several months ago, Catskill Mountain Keeper decided to push for a ban on the horizontal high-volume hydrofracking activity in New York State, and possibly with that to serve as a model for other areas around the country where people should be looking to see whether or not this activity can be done safely.
Yeah, it's so important when you mention the fact that our state is not alone in this, and that our whole country has been harmed by this. You know, many places have already been harmed by this because there has been a considerable amount of the hydraulic fracturing done in the U.S. as well as in other parts of the world. And there is this large potential for more of this activity taking place in the near future and in the not-so-near future, in the future. And we want to stop this so that the earth is not harmed and the public health is not harmed. Tell us about your new website.
Catskill Mountain Keeper just launched a new website to make the information that we've been gathering on this and other topics more readily available to our readers. The website is catskillmountainkeeper.org, and there's a section of the website on fracking and a page completely dedicated to the health effects of fracking. Basically, our feeling is that the more people know about fracking, how it's done, and what the likely public health hazards are, the more they're going to be motivated and the more they're going to push their elected officials to handle this activity in an appropriate way. And there are studies that show that in New York State, the more people know about drilling activities and the more they know about fracking, the more likely they are to be opposed to it. I think when a lot of people think about gas drilling, they have in mind something like what might be done out west, where you set up a rig and you drill down and you your drill enters some kind of lake of oil or gas that can then come back up like through a straw. And that is kind of what I would call old style or traditional drilling. And it has some hazards associated with it, but it's been going on for a long time. And the major problems that I see come with the newer types of activities in which either a vertical well like that, or in the case of horizontal hydrofracturing, a well that goes a mile deep and then a mile or more horizontally under, deep under the earth. With those types of drilling activities, the earth has to be fractured. The rock then releases little bubbles of gas that are dispersed throughout large areas of rock underground, and that escaping gas is captured in the drill, or not. The attempt is to capture the gas. But there's several layers of additional hazards that come when you start sending shockwaves into the earth, either in vertical fracking or in horizontal fracturing, the possibility to cause earthquakes is one that we've recently seen defined for horizontal hydrofracking. But in addition, you are creating pathways for release of more of the methane gas at the drilling site, and the chemicals and water that you need to inject into the earth to keep it open and let that gas escape are toxic chemicals. And with the pressure that they're injected, those chemicals can find new fracture pathways, potentially contaminating water supplies. So there's a whole additional set of potential hazards that come when you start fracturing the earth, and especially if you fracture multiple times in one site, which is currently the industry standard.
Okay. Let's get into the specifics of the chemicals first. This fracturing fluid, this hydraulic fluid that's used to fracture the shale deposit, what chemicals? I see a list of some chemicals here. The ones that I am familiar with as being carcinogens, they include benzene and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the PAHs,
yes.
Formaldehyde. These are known human carcinogens. It's good to see a list of the chemicals that are in the fracturing fluid on your website, because then people can do their own research and look into what adverse health effects come from exposure to these chemicals. What are
Yes.
some of the health effects that have been reported as associated with exposure to these chemicals in a broad sense, and then are these same health effects being seen with exposure to these same chemicals in cases where the hydraulic fracturing is going on?
Yes. Well, first let me say that the list that we have is not a complete list. It's just the compounds that are the most common and that are frequently used in these drilling sites. So part of the difficulty is we don't, in many cases, have full knowledge of what chemicals are being used at each site. But regularly they include these, and sometimes they include, although it's not legal, various forms of diesel fuel itself. So the industry has acknowledged using a large number of very toxic compounds like these. And the information about the harmful effects related to these chemicals is in many cases well known in other settings. The industry officials say that those harmful effects will not occur with hydrofracking because they believe their fracking fluid will be trapped deep underground in these layers and won't escape, that it can be confined. The trouble is that the existing fracking sites around the country don't bear that out, don't support the industry's claims. Many of these compounds are released into the air when the fracking fluid comes back out after the pressurized attempt to fracture the rock. The pressure is released and the fluid comes back up and can be aerosolized. it also contains gases which themselves may be difficult. We're just beginning to look at whether methane gas itself may be responsible for some of these health hazards. And the industry tends to let the fracking fluid accumulate in pits near the drilling site, and then the compounds in the pit can be aerosolized. And the casing that the industry uses to prevent their fluids from mixing with superficial water near the surface of a fracking site, those casings may not actually prevent that release of chemicals in the short or the long term. And as I said before, the deep water fluids that they've injected may also not be able to be contained. So there are places around the country that are have started using these techniques many years ago, several years ago, and are ahead of us in terms of seeing some of the repercussions. One of the places that is that has been studied quite a bit is Dish, Texas.
Okay.
Dish is a small community that is called Dish because they took on a contract to allow satellite dish service in their town. They were featured in the movie, the documentary Gasland by Josh Fox that was nominated for many awards. And Dish residents are reporting a variety of symptoms that are likely related to these drilling compounds. Headaches, asthma and other respiratory problems, severe neurologic disorders, precancerous lesions, impairment of motor skills. And those symptoms have been correlated with finding chemicals used in fracking in the town's air and water supplies. The chemicals that they've detected there are trichloroethene, benzenes, ethyl benzenes, toluenes, formaldehyde compounds. So the problem is that those compounds are there, and for people who live near the drilling sites, they're being exposed 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days.
What happens when this happens? You know, what is government is are these people just left to their own resources, and they just get as sick as they get, and you know, they have to either move away or just continue to get sicker, or you know, what happens? Is there any way that government is stepping in and helping these people out or protecting them once it's demonstrated, once it's found that they are actually being sickened by this?
Well, unfortunately, there hasn't been much remedy for these people around the country. The drilling industry in the 1990s sought and obtained exemptions at the federal level from the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and also from Superfund remediation cleanup. And until very recently, under the current administration, the Obama administration, we have seen the Environmental Protection Agency beginning to do some studies and report their findings in a way that seems to be accurate and complete. Until recently, that wasn't happening. And so the story of what was happening to these people was really not being told. The industry would approach the individuals, would maybe offer something to help them out, and often in exchange for giving them some funding to move out of the area or bring in clean water, would obtain a non-disclosure agreement so that nobody was telling the story. The movie Gasland began to break that began to open that up for public awareness, and now we have media turning its attention to this issue, and that's helping enormously. The New York Times has done studies on potential contamination pathways, and this information is beginning to get out. But for the individuals in the areas where drilling has come in under very poor regulatory structure, they're left with basically individual actions against this huge industry. You know, the corporations in this industry are some of the largest corporations in the world. And so it's very hard for individuals to stand up for their needs. In a few sites around the country where researchers have gone in and have started to produce this data, the state agencies have been relatively uncooperative because the out west, the local governments are very supportive of the drilling industries. They've been familiar with gas and oil for decades and sometimes hundreds of years in some of these regions. On the East Coast, we may have a chance to do a little better because we have the benefit of the experience they've had out west, and also because we don't have, hope we don't have quite that same supportive relationship with the industry.
Okay. Tell me, our group is Cancer Action New York, and we focus a lot on cancer and the environmental causes of cancer, the exposures to chemicals and carcinogenic agents that impose increased cancer risk. What is the state of the knowledge on the shale gas and cancer risk? You know, how much scientific knowledge exists on that particular part of the health impacts of the shale gas exploitation?
Well, there's some. It's difficult because we have to make the connection not only between the chemicals, the toxins, and the outcome cancer that we're looking at, but also establish the pathways. And it's a complicated picture because the possibility of contamination through the air, for example, will likely happen at almost every drilling site where there's open pits and where there's no special attention to capturing gases. But that's a relatively small population of people living nearby the site,
okay,
or potentially downwind. But there again, you get into how do you predict where the pollution with these contaminants, where it's going to go.
Right.
And the outcomes are often delayed in time, so you're not having something released on one day and within a week see an effect. So establishing exact numbers is difficult. That's in the realm of the air contaminants. In the water contaminants, it's even more complicated because the contamination of water may be far from the site, and it may be years or decades following the drilling activity. One of the places where there may be, strangely enough, more firm data sooner is in relationship to the actual use of methane gas as a fuel. It's recently, there have been some studies to look at methane gas, natural gas obtained from the Marcellus Shale on the East Coast. Our shale layers have a higher level of radioactive material, radium and radon gas, which is released in the drilling activities. And in New York and Pennsylvania, those radioactive elements have been measured, and there are calculations that are coming out that the use of the gas in homes and for vehicles as fuel may release that radioactivity. And that radiation is a well-known carcinogen that we haven't yet discussed. But the number of lung cancer cases that might result from all the current use of New York City residents of methane gas has been estimated by one researcher to be in the thousands to tens of thousands of new cases of lung cancer that we might expect over the next 10 years if despite a decrease in cigarette smoking. But because of the use of methane gas that contains high levels of radium.
And this is a very specific matter for our state, considering the fact that you stated earlier that it was our gas coming from these deep deposits, these shale deposits, that has the especially high levels of the radionuclides. And it's very, very interesting. It's good that people are... I'd like to state on your website from Dr. Christopher Portier. He's the director of the National Center for Environmental Health, which is part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And I just want to quote this. Studies should include all the ways people can be exposed, such as through air, water, soil, plants, and animals. And also this matter, really, there's an additional one, this one that is being discussed here, of actually burning the material in the home and then being exposed. It'll be the air in the home, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I bet they weren't thinking about that when they made that statement.
It was not just the air, actually, but it's also the sediments, the residues that can settle out on surfaces from having had the radon-containing gas burned in one's home.
Hmm. Yeah, what a Pandora's box, really.
Yes, what it reminds me and concerns me is, as a pediatrician, we have spent decades trying to encourage people to remove lead from their homes and to stop using lead-based paint and to basically clean the home environment. And here we have a fuel source being touted as clean and safe to use that may be as hazardous or potentially even more hazardous than using lead paint in your home. And we have an industry that is out championing the use of this fuel source. And I just have to think that we're coating these surfaces with harmful agents. And we should be going the opposite direction.
Exactly. And when you really think about all of this together, it seems amazing that anyone could be for this. You know, other than the people that are set to make large profits from doing it, it's amazing that government would be comfortable with this. When you just step back for a minute and think about, okay, you're coating these homes with radioactive material that is known to cause cancer, well established that it causes cancer. And then there's the emissions to the air, both from the trucking and all the running of the compressors, all this combustion of diesel fuel, and then the evaporation from these pits of the benzene and the formaldehyde and these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And then there's the contamination of the groundwater. It seems like that will be way more than what it would take to convince government, environmental people such as New York State DEC and the US EPA, and government public health people like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Center for Environmental Health and the New York State Department of Health. It would seem in a rational world that that would be far more than what would be sufficient to cause them to conclude that this was not acceptable where people are living. And yet it's not the case. Do you have any insight on that? You know, why is government just failing so miserably here?
Well, government is feeling pressures from two directions. We've been focusing on the public health dimension, on prevention. Government is being pressed to develop new fuel sources so that we are energy independent as a nation and for economic revival, or at least hoped for economic revival in our communities. And the industry, this industry, the drilling industry, much like the cigarette industry 50 years ago, is pressing very hard to say that there is no scientific proof that people are being harmed in the ways we've just been discussing. And they have a certain amount of weight in that their new drilling techniques are relatively new, and some of these health hazards, as we've discussed, will show up later. So we're arguing from toxicology and from pathophysiology and causal mechanisms. And the industry has been asking for a different kind of proof. So the response that we have to have as citizens, I think, is multifold. We need to do the studies in those areas where they have started using these more hazardous techniques and document the kinds of things that we have documented in Dish, Texas, in Pavilion, Wyoming, in places that have populations that have been exposed for longer. We should be able to show these effects and document them. But I think we also need to, here in New York State, where we haven't yet begun fracking, and in places where it's less, it's being used less than out west, is slow this down, because the longer we do not have it, the more time we have to gather that data from the communities that are already being exposed.
Yes.
And I think, as I said earlier in this conversation, the more people know about this, the less enthusiastic they are about it. And that's our hope with public officials in places that have not yet approved this activity, is that they will not approve it. They will not issue permits. They will not let people do it. And if they have any thought to do so, that they would do it with much, much stricter constraints than in the places where we're seeing people being harmed.
So some deadlines have come along here. The New York State DEC has closed the public comment period on the regulations for the high-volume hydraulic fracturing, as well as they've closed the comment period on the, I think they call it the draft supplemental generic environmental impact statement. These documents have been produced. There's a very much more important document in my mind that has not been produced. It is the, you know, one could call this, I don't know what they would call it if they ever do it. There should be a health impact assessment, some sort of document produced that deals with focus on public health results of this practice, looking at science as already exists, and also thinking logically and reasonably about potential exposures and what happens when chemicals are present in people's bodies that have caused some harm in past circumstances. It doesn't have to be the exposure to the benzene and the formaldehyde that occurred when factory workers were exposed. It is very relevant to the exposure to benzene and formaldehyde, no matter how they happen to be, you know, no matter what the source of the particular chemical is, it's still that chemical being in the person's body, and it causes the same harm. So let's talk about the calls of not only Catskill Mountain Keeper, but a considerable number of shale gas, stop shale gas activist groups for a health impact assessment. Can you give some history on that? You know, how long has it been going on? What has been done to try to get that done? And where's that?
The call for health impact analysis is an important one, and we have participated in that going back as long as we have been looking at the fracking issue, so 4 and 5 years back. There have not always been within the environmental review of activities such as drilling enough focus on the health issues. And so the health impacts analysis approach was developed actually by the World Health Organization as a way to address the fact that sometimes you actually harm people's health more than you destroy land or trees. And the call to bring this kind of analysis to the fracking issue has come because the health impacts are so severe, potential health impacts are so severe. The in New York, the Department of Environmental Conservation that's reviewing those draft documents was approached by Mountain Keeper and other organizations during its comment period and requested to do this kind of analysis. We also pushed for the New York State Department of Health to take this up, and one organization said that the other could do it, and the second one said the first one could do it, and basically they declined to do a health impact analysis. We encourage people to put that in their public comments. We expect that to be a comment that many people will have included, and we have hundreds of doctors in New York State and on the East Coast that have signed petitions trying to get this type of analysis from the government, but I'm not sure we're going to get it. And so what we've been trying to do as an alternative is find funding for independent health impact analysis that could be produced, because data is data, and it should be at least as good and maybe even better to have independent groups providing this data. It does cost money to do those studies, and so we have to find sources. We're talking to medical schools and schools of public health, trying to find partners to do the work that needs to be done, and provide more compelling evidence of what this industry has been doing in the places where it's already been attempted.
So then the health impact analysis would basically pull together all of the scientific knowledge that exists on the harm to health, the adverse health effects that have been observed in relation to people being exposed to these chemicals.
It would do that, yes. And in addition, at least in its broadest forms, it brings the communities that would be affected by an activity into the discussion of whether or not that activity should take place or how it should take place.
I see. So, that's an important part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't even aware of that.
The communities that currently have drilling happening around the country really had no say in the matter. With the exemptions that were given at the federal level and with the drilling industry seeing a potential for profitable activity, they basically came in and portrayed their industry in the most favorable light. There are millions of dollars going into media campaigns across the country to push clean, pure, natural gas. And it's methane. It's similar to propane and other gases. It's methane, but it's being portrayed as natural gas, the bridge fuel. And these communities have in them people who were being offered money to lease their land and for this thing that was being said to be a very good thing. And wherever they wanted, wherever the industry could find willing leasers, they've been able to set up their drilling activities. I think what the health impact analysis process does is give a structure for informing a community ahead of time as to the potential health impacts, even if we let the industry say that they're not proven yet, which I dispute. But even if we say they're just potential health impacts, a community should still have the opportunity to participate in the definition of their own future.
Right. So as far as you know, has a health impact analysis such as you described, has that ever occurred on shale gas anywhere, say like in Canada or in other states in the U.S. or internationally? Has there ever been a health impact analysis done for the shale gas?
Yes. The only health impact analysis I know for shale gas was done in Garfield County, and that's out west. And there was another one that was done in Alaska, but it wasn't on drilling health effects, but it wasn't shale gas. In Battlement Mesa, which is in Garfield County, Colorado, a health impacts analysis was originated. It was done in conjunction with the Colorado School of Public Health, and they set out to define the health risks and quantify them. And as they went forward, they began to find that there were documented health hazards, and the funding and the for the study was withdrawn, and the cooperation that they had had with local governments and officials for obtaining information was also withdrawn. And so we don't have a final report from that study. We do have the fact that it was beginning to show problems, and that the researchers themselves felt that if they were allowed to continue the analysis, that they would be able to produce the kind of proof that the industry has been saying doesn't exist for adverse health effects.
Then it will be quite an accomplishment if New York were to produce one of these, to have
yes.
the first finalized document. It'd be very, very great work that the Gas Coalition, you know, the Stop Shale Gas Coalition, could have accomplished even in that. Tell me, where do you think it's going to go? What's the next exciting step on this?
Well, in New York State, we have the Department of Environmental Conservation reviewing over 40,000 comments from the public, the largest number of comments ever submitted on any environmental review. I think that the final analysis that they produce will have to take into account that magnitude of opposition and the valid concerns of the public. Within that agency, I don't think there will be a move to say this can't be done at all. The agency will likely tighten and propose very strict regulations would be my hope and my expectation. I think it's unlikely that the agency will within itself say we won't permit this activity. So for myself and for Catskill Mountain Keeper and many of the other anti-fracking organizations, the push has to be at the political level with elected officials, senators, representatives, the governor, and perhaps other agencies to come in and say we're not going to pursue this and put pressure on the agencies to basically deny the type of generic permitting that is being requested in New York State, where the industry would basically be allowed to operate almost anywhere. So it's an uncertain future. It really depends upon how much the public puts pressure on
yes.
our elected officials.
And do you see that materializing? Is there any reason to believe and have hope that people in New York State are getting organized to create some big political obstacle to the shale gas exploitation?
The amount of opposition in New York State has already been tremendous. And I think there were many observers who would have predicted that gas drilling would already be taking place in New York State and in the Delaware River Basin. But the activities of the activists and the public have been considerable and have caused the initial environmental review documents that were released in New York were not implemented and had to be revised, and these 40,000 comments were unprecedented. Recently, there was a lobby day in Albany. It was a rainy, cold day, and over 1,000 people showed up. 600 signed up, but that was the max that was allowed to sign up to speak with their representatives about this issue. That kind of public outcry is very hard for politicians to ignore. And so comments to the local officials at town levels, towns across New York State and in Pennsylvania are enacting laws to zone out or prevent drilling activities either completely in their towns or marginalize them. County level governments are have taken action when the public demands it. So I think getting the word out about the harms and then encouraging people to take action is the best way to prevent this activity from taking place as a corporate activity. And then personally, I just would recommend to all your listeners that not to use natural gas, not to use methane gas in closed spaces, because we don't know where it's coming from. And some of the places that it comes from do have high levels of radioactivity. So until we sort out a way that people can screen and make sure that the gas that they're using in their homes is safe, I wouldn't recommend it. I certainly wouldn't want it for anybody I knew that they would be using it in a confined space. It just doesn't seem safe.
Yeah, I'm sure that's where they would all choose to use it. It's pretty much the kitchen and heating of a home, an enclosed place where people are breathing and touching things, and kids are crawling around the floor, and dogs and cats are coming and going and spreading stuff around. And it certainly is a whole new window on the risks that are involved with using a fuel that we don't know where it's coming from. It's a very good point.
The use in the home is definitely confined space. Whether or not it can be used outdoors as it is, you know, as a fuel for buses and used safely there, I also question, because materials go into the atmosphere and then come back out through rain and coat all the surfaces that we're encountering. Of course, you have whatever amount is in the fuel has a larger area, and perhaps it's dissipated. So I don't think that the information is yet, all the calculations and studies have been done to see how dangerous it is to use as a fuel in other settings. But I'm very skeptical about this. And the industry has been so reluctant to acknowledge the potential harms, even in the face of reasonable toxicology and public health considerations, that I find it very difficult to trust their reports of what they're doing and whether or not there are these compounds in materials that are being delivered to the public as a fuel, and certainly at the sites where they're trying to obtain the gas from the earth.
Well, I've been very inspired by your clarity of mind and your logical thinking and your depth on science and all these various aspects of what you're bringing to this fight. Can you share with us, you know, as kind of a beginning to wrap this up moment here, and in more than a moment, because I want to talk about it in just a moment, can you share with us some of your inspiring moments on this as far as what human beings will bring to protecting their health when the odds seem to be stacked against them? It's these big corporations against people that have other things to do, but they find it necessary to protect themselves when government's not doing its job?
I have been greatly inspired by the people who have stepped forward to tell their stories in movies like Gasland, in reports that are now starting to come out by researchers going into these areas, and their resilience in the face of having been in many cases tricked into allowing an industry to come in that has ruined their lives, and somehow they find a way to keep going. I think the individuals who are in elected office who are stepping forward and saying, no, not here, in the face of the world's largest industry, true heroes and heroines that we have to support, you know, wherever we find them. So there are individuals who are doing everything they can do in the face of a difficult situation, and I think that Each of us has the opportunity to do something, whether it's signing a petition, educating ourselves, and then educating our neighbors. I think films about drilling, such as Gasland, would make a great gift for people who are living in areas where this activity is planned or might be taking place. So I think that there are already people doing the work to try to protect the environment and move towards a future in which we don't use fuels that are this harmful, move towards renewable energy that is not based on carbon, that is going to harm us either by its greenhouse gas effect or by the methods that we have to use to obtain it. It should be a consideration in what fuel we're using, whether or not people are injured in the attempt to obtain that fuel.
Very well put. I'm thinking there's one more question I would like to ask you, and then we will finish our program here. Can you share with the listeners some of your understanding? You know, how do you understand this matter of, you know, you said right a moment ago that the local political leaders, the local elected officials, that they were willing to oppose the shale gas.
Yes.
What is it about our society and our political system that when you get up to the state level and then the national level, I've experienced that it seems even worse, but when you get to these non-local levels of government, that they are so much more on the team of the corporations, just do what makes money rather than carefully consider the protection of public health first and then accept things that make money that don't harm public health. You know, there's that kind of like that screening of the various possible economic activities and resource, you know, extraction activities. What is it? You know, what is going on with that?
That's a very interesting question. My first take on that is that as people rise in political office, they need to be successful. They need to be seen as successful in order to put themselves out for the next level up in government. And at the local level, the successes are measured by things that people can see. You know, how well have you done at keeping that stream clean is very readily apparent because people are living right next to the stream. But as you get to the higher levels of office, you basically are taking responsibility, in some cases for areas you may not see that frequently. Good politicians, I think, do go back and reconnect with their home districts, you know, even as those districts get to be larger and larger and even to the level of the state or the country. But many politicians become somewhat insulated from that real personal connection with the people they're serving. And they become more sensitive to the arguments of the people who have the money to go to them and show up at their office and say, look, you know, here's this great new energy source that's going to bring jobs and going to make our lives better for the future. And with shrinking resources for staff to do independent analysis, the politicians become more and more reliant on whatever information comes to them. So that's the reason I put so much emphasis on the role of individuals signing petitions, writing, or calling their representatives. We are the eyes and ears on the ground of what the impact of these activities is going to be. And if we can educate ourselves and then convey that to our elected officials, I think we can help them do a better job and resist those pressures that they get from lobbyists for this industry and various other industries that have something else as their agenda. I mean, it's quite reasonable that individuals at the grassroots level have public health, have our health as our main agenda.
Yes.
And if that is the case, then we need to convey it. As people have had financial difficulties over the past few years, I think the politicians have heard from them too, people saying, you know, I'm hurting, I need something, I need a job, which is fair for people to tell their elected officials as well. But I think we have to put into the mix alternatives, renewable energy sources that don't have these hazards. Those of us who aren't right next to a drilling site, those of us who have an income coming in that allows us to do it, have to become the voice for giving people an economic lifeline that isn't going to turn in itself into something toxic when they grab hold of it.
Yep, that is not a good deal at all, you know, to merely choose what appears to put money into the economy with no regard for public health. It's truly what has created this cancer epidemic that we live in at the current time, and to do it over and over and over again will merely make a bigger cancer epidemic out of, you know, the previous cancer epidemic, and say nothing about heart disease and diabetes and all these other diseases. It seems like this is a perfect moment for people to do, as you're saying, think about public health and then advocate for it, and just kind of this enough already approach when there is so much here in the St. Lawrence River Valley. See, we do not have the shale gas being proposed right here at this time,
mm-hmm.
and yet because there's so much cancer here, we focused on exposure to chemicals, which is a big part of the cancer problem here in the St. Lawrence River Valley. And then to think that elsewhere in our state there's this proposal and this consideration and this intention on the part of considerable part of the society, being the powerful people in the state government and the federal government, to take up this activity that's just going to impose more exposure to chemicals that cause cancer. But it's important to get involved on it.
Yeah, I don't know if in your area if you've seen much in terms of what is being called the transition movement, but it's an international movement in which local communities take responsibility for making the transition to the future. And one of the things that's encouraging to me in terms of public health, our health, is that as we move to a more sustainable future in terms of the energy that we use, in terms of eating more locally, in terms of living with less dependence on motorized transportation, we're talking about a whole set of changes that can make our lives healthier on many, many levels. And rather than look at each industry separately and each potential contamination separately, I think that switch to wanting each component that we bring into our lives to be healthy is a way for us to shift, to shift a mindset and create a healthier future for ourselves as individuals and then as communities. And if it takes root in enough communities, it will be reflected at the larger governmental levels, at the state level and at the national level. There'll just be too many people all around the country living in a different way for these industries to be given as much free rein as they have been in the past. People just won't put up with it. And
that's
if we can reach the point where we won't put up with it, then I think we will have accomplished what we need to accomplish.
Yeah, I'm thinking that is truly the solution for this shift in perspective and just this different mind to come to exist in the minds of many. That's when there will be victory on this and so many other things that are harming health that do not need to exist, because there are other things that can be done that do not harm health. It's very simple, really. And on that note, let's wrap this up. Just pitch your website so that people can go there and find this information and share it with others. Let's do that.
Yes, it's CatskillMountainkeeper.org, and you can also search for Catskills and drilling on any search engine, and we should come up as well.
Okay. Well, this has been wonderful, Kathleen. So good to, you know, kind of connect with. I met you at the rally in Albany that you were describing, which took place in the month of during January, just last month. And it was just so quick. It just all worked just zing, 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 you know, to get to talk on the radio program. So these things are working very well, you know.
I very much welcome the opportunity. That rally was really a great one and brought together a lot of people. I think that's how people who are working against drilling can encourage each other and make this kind of connection. I really appreciate the work that you're doing with the radio and getting this information out to people.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. You've been a very inspiring and very intelligent and well-spoken person to interview.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Have a great afternoon.
You also. Thanks, Tom.
This has been Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution, and we touched on a very important part of the changes that will come from the near future, these changes where people, as Kathleen has stated, just begin living in such a different way and thinking in such a different way that it won't work for the corporations to bring their proposals without any consideration for public health, and then the politicians merely accept these proposals because nothing else is being advocated for. There's change in the wind. It's going to happen. Love of the earth and people's beautiful, strong minds and abilities can create a beautiful world where we don't have to have diseases that are caused by doing things that were done in the past and that are being done now. This can end, and we can ban the high-volume hydraulic fracturing in New York State. We can go on from there to bring it to an end in the whole country. It shouldn't happen any place on Earth. This has been Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. I'm hoping all the listeners will get into this whole new way of living.